Broadcasting live from the Buckhead Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Legal Experts.
Good morning and welcome. It's another Atlanta Legal Experts radio show. I'm so excited to be here. Rich is here, my co-host and producer today, Rich Casanova.
Very excited. This is your first show for 2015.
I'm really excited. Happy New Year.
Yeah, same to you.
Yeah,
what a great year for 2014. And boy, you got a great lineup in the studio this morning.
I do. Today I have Catherine Bortz with Bortz Law. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. And she is actually a criminal defense attorney, and she focuses on juvenile court. So she is our expert for those types of law today. And then we also have Kessler and Solomiani today. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Who's talking here? Yeah.
Randy Kessler. Good morning.
Hi, I'm Randy Kessler. Right. And this is Rob Miller. It's not Marvin Solomiani, but he's the young gun that's doing all the hard work in our office.
And we're going to hear a lot about family law with
and
you guys.
Robert, how long have you been in practice or with the firm?
Been with them for about 3 years. Okay. Interned with them 3 years prior to that, so six total with the firm.
Nice.
He's the success story. He started as an intern, said, you know, we don't really need another lawyer. And he said, you're going to need me. And he was right.
There was room in your photo. I saw the group photo online. Yeah. Wow. How many people is in that photo?
About 25.
Wow. Nice.
Yeah, and I got the card in the mail. So
oh, sweet.
I feel very
look
privileged.
At you, yeah.
And we have last but not least, Terry McGinn, attorney at law.
Good morning.
Good morning. He's going to share with us a little bit about bankruptcy and Chapter 7 and Chapter 13.
I will, yeah.
Awesome. And this show has been brought to you by the 3A Law Practice Management. They help lawyers start and grow their practice, and also by Peachtree Offices, and they basically help you work virtually anywhere.
And actually, so, that's where we're broadcasting live from the beautiful Peachtree Office Studios with this amazing Buckhead view. Well, besides the smog. Well, not the smog. fog. Atlanta traffic's not that bad. We're not in California. Yeah.
Yeah, it does look pretty gloomy
out
there.
Yeah, but it's awesome. I like kind of a misty. I feel like we're in Seattle this morning, whatever. Yeah. Great day for coffee. And and a legal and some ale, some morning
some ale
for yeah, Atlanta legal experts if you're tuning in listening.
Thank you, Rich. You always bring the go ahead, just go ahead.
Am I done yet? I went to reach my coffee and then you back on the show, yeah. So am I done now? Or
yes, you're done.
Okay.
I just said thank you for your contribution.
You're welcome.
Okay, so we're going to start with Terry.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for being here bright and early.
Love being here. Love driving to Buckhead in the dark.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. With all those crazies out there. So Terry has practiced personal injury, consumer finance, and personal bankruptcy law in Georgia since 2009 in state and federal courts. He has over 35 years of consumer finance and executive management experience.
Yeah, you can see that by looking at me.
Actually, it's great because our viewers will get to see you on the website,
AtlantaLegalExperts.com. Ruh-roh.
Uh-oh.
And you can hear more of his bio, or you could see, not hear, you can read more of his bio on our website at AtlantaLegalExperts.com. Tell me, how did you get into law? Can you give me a little bit of your background?
Yeah, I'd always wanted to be an attorney when I was very young growing up, and late in life, I went to law school late in life and had an opportunity to do it, so I leapt at it. So this is kind of my fifth career.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. Yeah. So how did you get into bankruptcy?
I had been in the finance business for years, consumer finance in the Midwest and here in Atlanta, and it was a natural fit for me.
Okay.
I'd been on the other side of the bankruptcy statute prior to 1987 when it was revised, and now I'm on this side of it after the 2005 revisions.
Gotcha. Now tell me more about the difference between a Chapter 7 and a Chapter 13 case.
Well, a Chapter 7 under the Federal Bankruptcy Act has to do mainly with liquidations. In that case, a consumer, I do individual bankruptcy law, a consumer or a debtor turns his non-exempt property, if any, and I'll explain in a minute what non-exempt is, over to a trustee who converts it into cash to pay the creditors. Most Chapter 7 cases, which are commonly called straight bankruptcy cases, are no asset cases. So very, very few of the Chapter 7 cases that are filed in the state of Georgia are really nationwide. Most of the debtors in a Chapter 7 have no assets that the trustee can collect and distribute to the trustees. Chapter 13 has to deal with debtors who pay all or a portion of their debts under a supervised payment plan that's approved by the bankruptcy court. And it's typically over a 3 to 5 year period.
Okay. Now, who should not file a Chapter 7 bankruptcy case?
Well, the federal statute that governs the Federal Bankruptcy Act does not permit any person who's been granted a discharge in a Chapter 7 case that was filed within the last 8 years of filing. So if you've filed a bankruptcy, a Chapter 7 case, within 8 years and you were discharged, you're not allowed to file again. There's a kind of a sunset saying, we don't want you to file every other year.
Sure,
yeah,
that
so
makes
that's
sense.
What that happens.
Okay.
And if you're granted a Chapter 13, the statute says 6 years. So it's 6 years. So it's a less strict but still strict guideline.
Okay. Now tell me, what are the costs in filing a bankruptcy case?
Yep. A Chapter 7 case in Georgia now costs the consumer, the debtor who files, $335. And that's up recently from last year, the middle of the year. It used to be $307. Now it's $335 for a Chapter 7. $310 is what the cost is if you decide if the person decides they want to do a 13, mm-hmm. 310, so that's what it is.
Okay, so it's not too bad.
Not too bad. And the person filing bankruptcy, if they're in financial straits, has the opportunity to have the federal bankruptcy court waive their filing rights. And the measure is, if your income is less than 150% of the poverty line, mm-hmm. of course, the attorney representing the person has to submit a petition to the court and a motion when they file the petition. But it's possible that the court will waive the filing fee. Or if they've got some income, the court will finance the fee mm-hmm. up to four payments, four monthly payments. But you're not allowed to file the petition unless it's waived without the fee being paid.
What's okay. the poverty level? I mean, currently, is that state by state?
It is.
National, who determines that? Or what's the ballpark number on that?
It is a national figure that's put out by the Federal Trade Commission, and each state has its own different poverty level.
What's the numbers?
Enjoy rough numbers. It also depends. It depends on how many people are in the family.
Yeah.
And by that, I mean the family, the domicile where the people live, how many dependents, how many married. But basically, if you make $15,000 a year or less and you have a family of four, you're probably at the level of the poverty limit. But the statute says you got to be 150% of that or below. So typically, if you're a family of four or five and you're making $20,000 a year, most of the time, my experience is you're going to be able to get the fee waived or at least get it financed by the court.
Yeah. And I have a question for you. So how do you know if you're ready or, you know, what does the situation look like as a consumer to, you know, I don't know, what's my next step? You know, can you describe a little bit to the general audience that are listening?
Well, if you're asking me when does somebody know that they need help to hire an attorney, the answer to the question is everybody knows because their phones are ringing off the hook with bill collectors, who I used to be one, banging on the door for money, mm-hmm. and or they're a lot of times they're being garnished. Sometimes in the course of a divorce proceeding,
don't look at me.
Yeah, right, exactly.
One of the correspondents will call and say, "I've just been totally fleeced in court, and I don't know what to do, and I can't pay all my bills." Gotcha. And that might or might not be a situation that bankruptcy will allow relief from.
Gotcha. Okay. Tell me, how long does it take to file?
Well, when you file the when the attorney files the petition in bankruptcy for the debtor, it normally only takes a couple of days to put the file together mm-hmm. for me. But then you file the petition, and the process then about 30, 45 days after that, you go in for your meeting. And okay. about on a Chapter 7 case, about 1 to 2 months after that is typically when the discharge occurs or the relief occurs.
Okay. Now, will somebody lose everything? I know a lot of people think that when they file for bankruptcy, they're going to lose everything.
Yeah.
Is that the case?
It is not typically the case, especially in a Chapter 7. The only way somebody really loses all of their assets if the assets are considered under the Act non-exempt. So most people, as I indicated earlier, are a no-asset case, which means in the Federal Bankruptcy Act provides for state law to decide what property a debtor can keep. So the exemption amounts in Georgia are different than the exemption amounts in Alabama. And there's also a federal standard. But to answer your question directly, most of the time, most Chapter 7 cases are no-asset cases, which means people get to keep their furniture. They get to keep up to $5,000 in the value of a car or more than one car. So if you've got a 1979 Honda mm-hmm. that's worth $2,000, you typically there's no debt on it, and you're going to be able to keep that outside of the bankruptcy.
Okay. Okay, now tell me, when does court get involved? When does a person have to appear in court for a Chapter 7 case?
Well, that's a good. When somebody appears, so in other words, the attorney or whomever is filing the petition for you files a petition, the what's typically called the 341 hearing is about 30 days after the petition's filed. And what will happen is you'll go into court with the attorney. It's not actually a court. It's a hearing conducted by the trustee. There's no judge involved. Mm-hmm. So you'll go into the hearing, and the trustee will ask you being the person involved in the bankruptcy, ask you about your income, your assets. You have to bring your driver's license. You got to show proof of your Social Security number. You should bring in your statements, your bank statements that you've gotten, a recent pay stub. The trustee will basically act as the ombudsman for the creditors and try and protect their rights. That's the trustee's job.
Okay.
Well, we're listening to Terry McGinn on Atlanta Legal Experts Radio. And speaking of creditors, we've talked about the personal aspect of the individual. What about from the creditor's standpoint? Where do they sit in terms of dealing with Chapter 7?
Well, it depends on what kind of creditor you're speaking about. So there's two basic types, secured and unsecured. Unsecured creditors are ones where credit card companies, they don't have, there's no assets backing the loan that they've made, essentially.
Okay.
Secured creditors, obviously, are the opposite, but they've got some collateral involved.
But, I mean, where do they fit into the picture? What's the, you know, process or...
For a secured creditor, is basically protected under the Federal Bankruptcy Act on the assets that they've pledged for the indebtedness that they've lent out. So as a bankrupt going into court, you've got a couple of options as to what you want to do with that property that's secured. Number one, you can say, I'm going to give this back to you. I can't afford the car that I've got a loan against. Here are the keys. They're required to take it back.
Oh, they are?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they got to take it back because they've got to preserve their own interest and liquidate the asset to you know, get their as much of their money back as they can. The other provision that can be happened is that you can go ahead and say, well, I would love to try and keep this property.
Right.
Can we work out some payments? That's called a reaffirmation agreement. And they reaffirm the debt. The attorney tries to help them negotiate that. And then there's actually a document filed with the court. The other thing they can do is the bankrupt can say to the creditor, well, look, I owe you $3,000 on this car. I owe you $3,000 on the car. The car's worth $1,000. I want to keep the car.
Right.
Here's $1,000. And if that's the value of the car, they're required to take that money.
Really?
Yeah.
So I would think it's more kind of more negotiable or arbitration or issues, but there's a lot of built-in requirements, which is what you're kind of stating.
Oh, there's a lot of federal law, right?
Thank you.
A lot of requirements, right.
So what's your biggest challenge in your day-to-day practice and operation?
The biggest challenge.
Or misconception, I guess, as well.
The biggest misconception is what was stated earlier, that, hey, I don't want to go bankrupt because I don't want to lose my house.
Right.
99% of the time, if you're a homeowner in bankruptcy, you keep your house.
And is it still true that most bankruptcies personal occur due to medical issues, or is that
medical has a big component of it? I will say candidly that probably in my practice, what I see the biggest factor is that people get addicted to credit cards, etc., and you got to break the cycle. And under federal law, you know, you have a right to a fresh start. Delta Airlines is a company that went bankrupt and emerged stronger than before. That's the essence. That is the kernel of what bankruptcy law really does, is try and help people get started again.
Right.
That's what I've heard other people say, is that they actually have a fresh start,
Absolutely. And let me just interject this also, that creditors, especially credit card companies, are fine under bankruptcy. Right. The reason why the rest of us pay the interest rates we do is because it's built into their metric. Mm-hmm. It's built into their metric, and they're writing off balances that the rest of us, and the loss of interest that they're getting, the rest of us are paying for.
Yeah. No, I mean, it makes sense. It's been working for a lot of years, right?
A lot of years. Yeah. And it was revised in 2005. It was revised because it used to be pretty draconian before 2005, that you could basically go bankrupt and not have to. No consequences.
Now there are consequences, which is good.
Yeah. Yep.
So Terry, tell our listeners the best way to get in touch with you and find out more about your services.
Well, you can go to my website, bestlawga.com. That's bestlawga.com. Or you can call me at the office at 770-856-9690.
That's a great domain. I mean, you can't really top Best Law. They're second best. I was going to buy the domain Second Best Law. Yeah.
Oh, good. Maybe I'll try and get that one, too.
Yeah, right.
And just a reminder today, too, that our show has been brought to you by 3A Law Practice Management and Peachtree Offices, as we break to our next, or go to our next guest, Kessler and Solomiani. Family law attorneys. Thank you, Randy and Robert, for being here.
Pleasure.
Sure.
It's great to have you. And I'll start with Randy's bio. He is the founding partner of the 13 Lawyer Atlanta Family Law Firm, even though we have 25 people in that picture.
Or more, whatever.
Well, we have paralegals and staff.
I think there's more. They just, that's all they could fit with a wide-angle lens, whatever,
Find some guys on the street and say, come on in.
Right.
Nice. He has practiced family law for over 25 years, and he frequently represents high-profile individuals, particularly athletes and entertainers. He is very much involved in the family law sections of the American Bar Association, Georgia Bar, and Atlanta Bar. And tell me a little bit about the book that you wrote, Protect Yourself.
Yeah, it's something I started 25 years ago. It was sort of the initial consultation. What would I want people to know before they came to see me? Mm-hmm. Because I spend half of my time telling them the same thing to the same people. You know, divorce, you can get through it. Or, you know, don't leave the house unless there's violence. You should stay in the house and try to preserve, you know, the status quo. Things like that are just very true in a lot of cases. So I put it down after 5 years of trying to get it right, and then I picked it back up 15 years later and just had to get it out, you know. So it's called Divorce, Protect Yourself, Your Kids, and Your Future. You can get it at www.divorceprotect.com. And it's the kind of thing that a lot of lawyers got mad at me. They say, why are you giving away this free stuff? Why are people able to read this that you could charge them by the hour to talk about mediation? But I just feel like, you know, the tools are out there. Everyone needs to know about them. And then the question is, how do we use them? So I like when someone comes in and says, well, I read about mediation in your book. Tell me more about that. That appeals to me. Or I read about, you know, judges in this county and how you have to know your judge. Do you know the judges that will handle my case? And so they're asking better informed questions. And I think it's a good starting point for anyone who's thinking about or might be thinking about going through a divorce.
Sure. It could change their mind either way.
Yeah. Well, and I think it'll put them at ease, saying there is a path. That's the worst thing. People are fearful that I'll never be able to get beyond this.
Right. Gotcha. And also, he is a LinkedIn influencer. I like to say that. 135,000 followers. He is often quoted in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, People Magazine, Newsweek, Sports Illustrated, and many, many more, and on Atlanta Legal Experts. Thank you so much.
That's at the top of the list.
Yeah, that just got moved up, whatever. Sorry, Nancy Grace, yeah.
And now we also have Robert Miller.
Pleasure.
Thank you so much. He has began his legal career at Kessler & Solomiani as an intern while attending law school. After graduating, he worked as a clerk and then until taking full-time associate position at another prestigious family law firm in Atlanta. In 2012, he returned to Kessler & Solomiani, bringing with him a wealth of knowledge in matters related to divorce, child support, child custody, legitimation, paternity, and adoption. He's extremely active in the Atlanta legal community and is a member of the Young Lawyers Division and Family Law Section of the State Bar of Georgia. And you did graduate from California State University, and your BA and MA in history with an emphasis in modern Germany and Holocaust studies.
I took the circuitous route.
Where in California?
I went to Cal State Fullerton, born and raised in Orange County. I've lived here for about 6 or 7 years.
I went to FSU, the other FSU.
There you go, the other
FSU. The other FSU, yeah.
What we say out there.
Well, I went to both. I went to Florida State and Fresno State, but yeah. Meanwhile, sorry.
I'm not an
attorney yet.
And then you earned your JD from Atlanta's John Marshall Law School, where you excelled academically and was an active member in student government. You and your wife, Jessica, make your home in Sandy Springs with your son, Harrison. Now, how old is he?
He's 3. We actually have a 3-month-old Dylan who is keeping me busy, busy in the mornings. Yeah.
Wow. So 3-year-old and a 3-month-old.
That's right. That's right.
Fun.
Yeah.
Great. Well, tell me a little bit more about how you got into family law as well.
Well, I've always been interested in family law. I was not always interested in being a lawyer, but I knew that... once I made that decision, that was kind of the route I was going to take. Mm-hmm. I made it about 2 years before law school. I actually, Paul McCartney, I'm a big Beatle fan. Paul McCartney said he dreamed the song Yesterday. I actually was in New York, and I had a dream that I was going to be a lawyer. And I woke up in the morning and said, that's what I'm going to do. And that's what I did. Went to John Marshall Law School. Actually had Randy as a family law professor.
Uh-huh.
And that's just kind of been my route.
And I want to brag on Rob for a second. He made it. You know, we teach the class twice a year, and there are 40 or 50 students in the class. And, you know, all of them want jobs, and everybody's trying to get their foot in the door. And we've always said we're going to teach just to teach, not to try to find, you know, employees. And Rob just appealed to us and said, listen, this is what I want to do. Give me a shot. And he worked his way in, and we gave him a shot, and he lived right up to it and did everything he said he was going to do, worked his behind off. And is an excellent lawyer. Now it's fun watching him go to court, hearing him come back with his stories about what happened in court. He's a real lawyer, and he's a real good lawyer.
That's awesome.
I thought he maybe represented Paul McCartney, one of his divorces or something.
I wish that was nice.
If you wouldn't be here.
Speaking of, you do a lot of high-profile cases. Can you tell me a little bit more how you got into that? And
well, you know, we've been lucky, or some would say unlucky, but, you know, I enjoy it. I enjoy seeing the people that have, you know, varied lives. And all of us, all the lawyers in here, see different types of people from all walks of life. And the heart of the matter, they're all the same. They all have same human emotions. And when you see somebody that's been on TV or on the playing field or on the basketball court come in and say, I need help, it's very empowering to be able to say, who am I? I'm this, you know, short little white guy that's going to tell the 6'7" NBA athlete how he's going to be able to see his kid more or get to spend time with his daughter. So it's very, it feels great to be able to help them. But the way we got into it is I used to sort of have a bone to pick with these high-profile guys that wouldn't pay child support, and they had the money. Mm-hmm. And so I'd take on a woman that had a kid with a child, with an athlete who wasn't paying, and I'd say, we can't get paid now, I understand. When we collect the money, hopefully you'll have enough money to pay us, but if not, we're going to at least help you get, you know, the money, and we'll set an example. And we went after some people that really were not good people and were really taking, you know, advantage of the poor women that all they wanted was a relationship with the guy, saying, call your son, send him a pair of tennis shoes. And I would file lawsuits for $100,000 owed, and the guy would call and say, I'm going to come visit this week if you'll drop the lawsuit. And they'd call me, and we'd drop the lawsuit.
Wow.
But sooner or later, word got out that, you know, we knew and understood the NBA pension plan and the NFL pensions and how their salaries worked and those cases. And then a lot of times the athletes and the entertainers started coming to us first so that we wouldn't be on the other side.
Right. Wow.
So that's sort of how we got into it.
Wow, that's amazing.
It was interesting.
Yeah. Tell me, let's get a little bit more into the law. Tell me about divorce and what is an uncontested divorce?
Well, an uncontested divorce is exactly what it sounds like. It's when two people can come together and say, listen, you know, we have assets, we have kids, we know how we want to divide all the assets, we know what we want to do as far as a custody arrangement. And they come to us and they say, here's what we want, A, B, C, D, E. And all we really have to do as attorneys is file the lawsuit and get a settlement agreement approved by the court. That can usually take, you know, once we file, it can take 30 days and we can have you divorced. Wow. The opposite, of course, is the contested divorce, which
sure.
Is probably 90-95% of what we do and what keeps us in business. And that's what you hear about.
Right. See on the movies.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And I do want to mention, it's not uncontested just because you both agree you want a divorce. We hear that all the time. People come in and they say, oh, it's uncontested. We both agree we want a divorce. Okay, well, what about the house, the kids, the child support? Oh, well, we'll work that out. You know, yeah. That's a contested case. So.
Gotcha.
Yeah, a lot of times they'll come to us, they'll say, we have it all figured out. And then we say, well, what's happening with the dog? What's happening? You know, is your husband going to see the kid every other weekend? And then they go, you know, actually, we haven't agreed on everything.
Right.
And then it turns out to be a year-long $70,000 divorce.
Yeah. Probably individually they have it figured out in their mind, right? Yeah.
Right. They think they've talked about it too, and they have.
Yeah.
A lot of times they just haven't done it to the extent that we need them to.
Or in writing. It's different when it goes into writing,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yep. Yep.
Absolutely.
Now tell me, how does the court determine when there's children involved, the child support aspect? Randy, if you want to answer that? Or
sure. You know, when I started practicing law, the way it happened is my side would present a budget, and the other side would present a budget, and the judge would have to figure out how much money can the non-custodial parent afford, and how much money does the custodial parent need, and strike a balance. Then the federal government said every state has to have guidelines so that it's not just up to the luck of the draw and how the judge feels that day. And so there are uniform guidelines. Each state has their own. Georgia just changed theirs, and they're very complicated, but I'm going to make it very simple. It was so complicated for me to look at it and plug the numbers in on the Excel spreadsheet that we decided to create an app. So if you look up Georgia Child Support or Georgia Child Support Calculator, it's a free app. It's sort of like the book, something that helps people that, you know, we could charge them for, but I don't feel right charging people to explain this. You plug in about 8 variables, your income, the other side's income, child care cost, health care cost, and it spits out a number. And that's the presumptive number that we start with.
Okay.
And, you know, people say, what about these high-profile cases? Well, if you earn over $30,000 a month in Georgia, the starting point is about $2,000 a month for one child, $3,000 for two children. Then it's up to the lawyers to say, but this kid needs a lot more of their special needs, or this dad has to fly in from California to visit, so don't make him pay all that child support so he can afford a flight. But we've seen it all over the map. You can be very creative. You can pay direct expenses for school in lieu of some portion of your child support if you agree on that. So hopefully people will agree and they'll figure out what the child really needs, and then they won't need us.
There you go. There you go. And I was going to ask a follow-up question to that, and I just lost my train of thought. Sorry about that. But I will read the next question. I am divorced and was ordered to pay child support, but I've lost my job. What do I do?
Well, you're going to want to come to us or come to somebody and file for modification of child support.
Okay.
You need to show a significant change in your financial circumstances. And again, you come to us and hopefully, you know, the opposing party will understand your circumstances. A lot of times they don't. But we're going to have to get a budget for you. You're going to do discovery. You're going to get us some tax returns, some basic financial information. And we're going to petition the court to get your child support modified.
Okay. So that's a modification.
Yep.
Now, how to find, you said come to us. How is it? How would you suggest finding a good lawyer for this type of?
Well, a lot of times,
I can think of one firm or whatever.
Right, right. Well, for you know, Randy's in
it's a little bit of a loaded question, isn't it?
Yeah. How do I?
It's on the sheet.
That?
Oh, it is okay. Yeah. Or I guess, what are some criteria that you look
criteria.
For?
Yeah.
Well, here's personally what I would do. First, I would come to us. Second,
good answer, Randy. Right there.
Second, you know,
get to keep your job.
Word of mouth is huge. If you've everyone knows someone who's been divorced. If you can get their opinion on what their attorney did for them, if they like them, I think that's a great marketing tool.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Randy obviously has done the books and has done the lectures and has on TV, and that's a great marketing tool for us as well. But I think if you can find someone you trust, and especially once you've found that person and they've sent you somewhere, I think you need to call, make an appointment, go meet them in person and see if they mesh with you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Randy, did you want to say anything else?
I agree with Rob 100%. If you don't know someone who's been divorced that you feel comfortable asking, call the lawyer that you know. If you don't know a lawyer, find a lawyer, find your friend's lawyer, even if it's not a divorce lawyer. Because most divorce lawyers, like the few sitting in this room, specialize or do one thing. And a lot of people, a lot of lawyers, don't like handling divorce cases for a lot of obvious reasons. The hands go up. Beauty of radio. All the hands in the room went up. But they say, you know what, I don't like doing this, but I know some guys or some folks that are really good at it, and they like doing it. So a good lawyer will hopefully know a good divorce lawyer. And that's probably the best way to find somebody if you don't know someone who's gone through a divorce, like Rob says.
Gotcha.
Okay. What about folks that are not married? I mean, where do they kind of fit in the equation? Again, common law marriages in Georgia? I mean, what's the...
There's no common law marriage in Georgia.
Okay.
So, you know, you're not going to be talking about equitable division of, you're not going to be talking about equitable division of property if you're not married. You will need to figure out a custody arrangement if you have kids. Mm-hmm. And generally what happens then is that if it's a male, he'll file legitimation. That was legitimation. and he'll seek to establish his custodial rights. Uh-huh. Men in Georgia who are not married do not have any custodial rights, but they do have child support obligations. So
that seems a little unfair, right? I mean, there's two people involved in that equation. And if you're asking them to pay, I mean...
You know what it is? It does sound unfair.
Yeah,
and a lot of things in the real world sound unfair. When you think about them in the family law context, they start to make sense. We know whose baby it is, 100%, until reproductive technology at least. We knew that baby comes out of mom. Mom's the mom. Right. But for the dad to make sure that it's his child, he's got to do something.
Right.
And he's got two things. He can marry the mom, and then it's presumed to be his child.
Right.
Or he can file a case and do DNA testing. But that way, the child, but at least the important stuff, getting the child taken care of financially, if it's his kid, he's on the hook. So he should find out right away whether it is or is not his child, and then send some money. Like Rob said, you can't just put your head in the sand. You got a baby in this world, you got to send something.
Yeah, I agree on that. But I mean, once it's determined that it is his child, then he has rights.
Yeah,
right?
Okay. Just like, you know, when you're married, you have a kid, it's joint custody.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
When you legitimate, like Rob said, then you have joint custody, and the court has to decide who the child's going to live with. So Rob's right. Men have to file something, or don't complain 5 years
right.
later when you take your kid to Disney and she says, nope, and the cops come and take your child from you. You say, but we've been living under this arrangement.
Right.
You got to make it official.
Yeah, that makes sense. What about same-sex marriage in Georgia? What's the status or update?
This is a rapidly changing landscape nationally and in Georgia. I think it's probably important to talk nationally first and then get to Georgia. But going back to 1996, you had the Defense of Marriage Act, which is known as DOMA. It was signed by Bill Clinton. And basically what it did, it federally defined marriages between one man and one woman. That was struck down recently in the case of United States versus Windsor, which is the one that everyone heard about back in 2013. Really quickly, what happened there was... Windsor and Spire were a same-sex couple. They lived in New York. They were married in Canada. Spire died, leaving her estate to Windsor. Windsor tried to claim the state tax exemption for surviving spouses. She was barred federally and had to pay $363,000 in estate taxes that she wouldn't have otherwise paid if they were married. In a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court said that Section 3 of DOMA, which federally defined marriage, was unconstitutional as a violation of equal protection. So what happens? All of a sudden, states now start to try to get their laws held unconstitutional. And the problem with the states is that, you know, our attorney general, and it's happening here in Georgia, the state attorney general start to use the same defenses that the federal government was using, and that was protection of traditional marriage, responsible procreation, and optimal child rearing. Well, those were all kicked out under Windsor. So it's not surprising that under state law, they're also being kicked out. And in 2014, 27 states allowed gay marriage. And they all cited Windsor.
Changes every day.
It literally changes every day. So in Georgia, you have the 2004 Constitutional Amendment Number 1, which said it was unconstitutional to recognize out-of-state marriage or perform gay marriages in the state. That was voter-approved 76%. It's also codified at OCGA 19330. Prior to Windsor, prior to 2013, there was a challenge in 2006, and it was actually struck down as unconstitutional in the lower court. However, it was overturned in 2007 by the Georgia Supreme Court. So where we stand is that it is now constitutional. The latest challenge came in a case that's currently pending right now called Innis v. Adderholt. And in April 2014, again, post-Windsor, the plaintiffs argued the same thing. It was a violation of equal protection and a violation of due process. In July 2014, the Attorney General filed to have the case dismissed. And again, he used the same exact arguments that were turned over in Windsor, which was encouraging procreation and exercising prudence from departing from traditional marriage. Actually, last week, January 8th, the federal court refused to dismiss the case. And the federal court said, these conclusory assertions are not supported by specific facts. So, you know, the case is going to proceed on the merits. I would predict that it'll be held unconstitutional based on that language.
The ban on gay marriage in Georgia
will
be held unconstitutional, is what Rob's saying.
Now, that's probably going to be appealed. In fact, it will be appealed. Attorney General Sam Olens ran under that platform recently and was reelected. And he said, I will defend the laws of the state. So that will go up on appeal and will probably be overturned.
And by the end of the show, there'll be another update or whatever. Right? Yeah. Like Randy was saying, it changes by the hour almost.
Yeah, right? I want to make it clear. I know this is
very fluid.
It's a public forum and I'm probably going to be held to this, but I just want to, I know we don't make political statements, but I want you to know I'm absolutely 100% in favor of same-sex divorce.
Yeah.
We think same-sex
couples definitely more business, whatever. Yeah.
You know,
of course.
The truth of the matter is, it gives people a way to resolve their differences. People that are of the same sex are getting together. They are creating families. They are having businesses, and to separate and segregate them is actually right now very expensive and very complicated. So to allow them the process of divorce would at least give them some predictability and some uniformity, and it would be a helpful mechanism to create more civility. You know, without laws, you have chaos, and the same-sex community is. They're in chaos right now trying to figure out how do we separate our assets.
Speaking of chaos, I mean, with athletes and... yeah, I know you had a question about spousal issues,
I did,
issues,
I
right?
did. And now I'm not being abused, and I know my husband's wondering why I have all these family law attorneys on the show.
Well, it is interesting that you just happen to have Randy's book. I was saying last time you should just have this on your coffee table at the house, just sitting there, whatever, divorce, protect yourself, your kids, and your future, and get Kevin, your husband's response, like, how did this, where did this book come from? Yeah.
It's funny how many arguments you win when you do that.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Well, I know that this happens a lot, unfortunately, the abuse that happens in homes. And can you tell me a little bit about that briefly, because we do need to sum up.
You mean in the context of what we're seeing with the NFL and the players?
Yeah.
And all?
Yes.
Or just from both perspectives. Yeah, the average citizen. Well, but there's a lot of media coverage right now.
Yeah, well, one thing I'll tell you, and you know, we have 13 lawyers, and we see people from all walks of life and all across the economic spectrum. But it doesn't change whether you're rich or poor, black or white, you know, wherever you're from. People that we hear it all the time. I can't believe that he would do something like that. And just like we've heard in the media, it's like that. People are different at home, and we all have our baggage, and we all have our luggage, and we all have things that we do that we're ashamed of. But the bottom line is, get help. And there's a thing called the battered women's syndrome, or the battered women's circle or cycle. It's called a lot of different things by psychologists. But it's, you know, sort of encaptioned by this book that I read once called I Hate You, Don't Leave Me, you know? And it's actually a sentiment that rings true for a lot of people, especially a lot of women. What am I going to do without him? I know he's done this, but he won't do it again. And it's very hard. And so if you've got a friend that's going through it, do whatever you can to get them help. I'm not saying they need a divorce, but they need therapy or they need some separation, because people are terrified of leaving, of separating, not knowing that there's a possible future. And once they know that they can get beyond it and that that's not the way life's supposed to be, they can move beyond it. But it is prevalent. And I don't think it's just all of a sudden in the NFL and out there in society. I just think there's more sunlight on it. There's more internet. There's more video cameras on elevators. Yeah, so people are getting caught more. Yeah. But I think it's been a problem for a long time. And now it's coming to light, and it's a good thing that it's coming to light.
I was about to say, because that could actually help the situation, help the issue. Great. Well, thank you so much for being on the show, and we look forward to hearing if we have a little bit of time left later on in the show, but please tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you.
Let's see. The book is at divorceprotect.com, and the firm, the easy way to remember it is atlantadivorcelawyer.com. That'll go right to us, atlantadivorcelawyer.com.
And you can also reach us at 404-688-8810.
The young guy gives the phone number. The old guy gives the website. Oh, yeah.
What's wrong with this picture? Yeah, right. Great, great. And now we have, last but not least, and thank you for waiting
Passionately.
Thank you. I'm a mix of words today. Catherine Bortz. Good morning.
There. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And thank you for being here. And she's with Bortz Law, LLC in Atlanta. She is focused exclusively on criminal and juvenile defense matters. So I thought this would be a great addition for the family law.
Absolutely.
And even the Chapter 7 and 13 cases.
Sure.
So, you know, you guys, I think y'all switched cards already, didn't you?
They all go together.
Awesome.
One of these leads to the other, that's for sure.
Absolutely.
I love that. So she's a seasoned trial attorney with 10 years experience in criminal defense. She's a highly esteemed member of the Atlanta and national legal community. She is an AV preeminent attorney, Martindale Hubbell's highest ranking, a top 100 trial attorney in the state of Georgia by the National Trial Lawyers Association, and was recently named top 10 criminal defense attorney under 40 by the National Academy of Criminal Defense Attorneys. She is actively involved in her community, serving her neighborhood's parent association, the Virginia Highlands Morningside Parent Association, and has extensive leadership experience with the Junior League of Atlanta and the Young Lawyers Division of the State Bar of Georgia. She's passionate about working with youth and their families. That's what I saw before.
Yeah, there you go.
And practicing juvenile law, and has a book coming out, another book, in the spring for parents about juvenile defense in Georgia. We definitely have our experts here today. Thanks again for being here.
Thank you so much, Emily.
So tell me a little more about how you got into the juvenile side of the criminal law.
Yes. Well, I actually started off as a public defender in Fulton County and really enjoyed it. It was an eye-opening experience. I was able to handle cases from minor theft cases all the way to murder cases, many of them trials before a jury.
Wow.
And really, it was such a great experience. And from there, I was able to practice with a small boutique law firm here in Atlanta, doing also exclusively criminal and juvenile defense. I was able to practice in courtrooms all across the state, and I just really grew to love working with the families and mm-hmm. with the kids. You know, it's mm-hmm. not, you're obviously representing the child, mm-hmm. but you are working with the entire family, and I'm very passionate and feel that I have a good demeanor with the families and really enjoy talking to them and getting to know them. And so back in June of 2013, I started Bortz Law. And the two cornerstones of Bortz Law are that just compassion and creativity. One of the things I think I said earlier, when people are going through, whether it be a juvenile and their family or anyone who's going through the criminal process, mm-hmm. they're not having their best day.
No.
They are their best year, for that matter. Yeah. And so I really... you know, understand that they need to be treated with compassion. Mm-hmm. And many times they feel that everybody in the system, whether it be the judge or the prosecutor or the probation officer, or the sheriff, any of the key players, whether it really is that way or not, they feel that everyone is against them. And so right. as the attorney, I really focus on just giving them the compassion that they need mm-hmm. and, you know, letting them know that I'm for them. And, so that is one of, and then the other side of it, the creativity. And I know you asked me about the juvenile law. I kind of went into my practice
that's
as
great.
Well.
Yeah.
Is creativity. And mm-hmm. I have a journalism background and public relations. So I've always enjoyed the creative process. And people may not think there's a place for that in law, but I really believe that there is, especially doing criminal defense and negotiating with mm-hmm. prosecutors is something that I do quite a bit. The reality is most cases don't go to trial, so to really be able to work things out and save the person that stress mm-hmm. is something that I really, you know, enjoy doing. And so creativity can be found, whether it be negotiating a lesser charge for your client, which won't mm-hmm. impact them as severely, or whether it be trading you know, doing counseling or therapy instead of probation, which may be something that's more beneficial and right. that all parties are happy. So I do feel that there is room for compassion and creativity, and I feel like that's what Bort's Law is all about.
Well, that's awesome, and that you are very passionate about what you do. I love it because you kind of found your niche, and it's great for your clients. I'm sure they really depend on that in their time of trouble.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Tell me a little more specifically about the juvenile cases.
Sure. Juvenile
like
cases.
What types?
Okay. One thing I'm seeing a lot of are cases that start off in the school system. So whether it's a fight, kids get into a fight at school, or somebody steals something, or, you know, makes something that they might say rises to the level of a terroristic threat, which I don't know how I feel about all that, but there are definitely situations that arise at school. And the climate in our schools, it seems like schools want to put out the image that they are, you know, tough on crime, and that, that you know, zero tolerance policies are really prevalent. And so situations where you would think, you know, should be resolved within the school are getting just shipped right over to the juvenile court. And you've got prosecutors that'll even say to me, I don't even really understand why we're handling this case here.
Wow.
So, but the result of that is the parents are really very stressed out about it. And so so we do see a lot of the schools, and that's where I come in, of course.
Sure.
But the school cases, but then you also do see cases that happen off of school property, shoplifting. I've handled sex crimes, robbery cases, really the gamut, but a lot of the school, really our climate now with the social media and the hustle bustle of our lifestyle really kind of put some of these kids in the path of juvenile court, where I wonder if that was happening as much in the past.
Yeah, because I was thinking, I remember going to my elementary school and there was a big old wooden paddle hanging up there as soon as I walked in the, and this does age me a little bit.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time in the principal's office or whatever, yeah.
And I mean, I don't think they ever even used it, but it was hanging
there.
Oh, no,
we used it in Florida. They used it or whatever, yeah.
So it's they took it into their own hands. And now, I guess, when do you think the shift happened? I mean, just gradually, I guess, just trying to be more PC. And
I don't know if it's liability or maybe more people are filing lawsuits, but I think in some of the private schools, I do, I have spoken with just some different people about, you know, issues in private schools where maybe there is a little bit more leeway as far as the paddling goes, but, you know, certainly not in a public school.
Right, Yeah, that makes sense. So tell me, you have that legal guidebook that you were talking about earlier, and it's coming out this spring.
Yes. So I have decided, sort of similar to what Randy had mentioned, as far as the conversation that you have with your clients when they first meet with you, I've put a lot of that in writing. It's certainly not any legal treatise on juvenile law, but it really is just... it is a tool for parents that whose child may be... going through the juvenile court process, or if parents just want to, you know, get their, you know, build their knowledge base and, you know, talk amongst their family about it. But the book handles just what to expect, how to prepare for court, issues with sealing a juvenile's record, and how to interact with law enforcement. And it basically just answers some questions and gets the conversation going.
Gotcha.
And I found that with a lot of parents, if their child ends up in juvenile court, a lot of it is just the stress comes from not knowing what's going to happen and how is this going to affect my child and is their life over? And so just the information really, that is my goal in putting this book out.
That's awesome. So it helps them actually before they get to you and they become more educated, or maybe during.
Absolutely.
Gotcha. That's,
absolutely.
That's great. And tell me, you mentioned the juvenile cult code. What is this?
And I may not have mentioned it actually, but that is actually another part that I included in my guidebook. There recently were some changes in the juvenile code, and I focused in my book just on some of the new updates regarding the delinquency side. Delinquency is the lingo for the juvenile kids that get in trouble, you know, is the delinquency side. Juvenile court handles other matters that, you know, other attorneys, such as our wonderful esteemed family attorneys, may be handling as far as deprivation and issues along those lines. But the delinquency, the changes in the law as far as affecting the juvenile delinquency proceedings, just a couple that that I've noted in my guidebook, the attorney now has access to documents that may help them in defending the child, such as school records, other documents from other agencies, medical records, things along those lines, simply with the child's consent and a court order. So the parental consent is no longer part of the equation. So that's one of the changes. Now a prosecuting attorney must file the petition, which is the charging document with the allegations that of the crime versus another interested party. And the parties in a juvenile case are now the child and the state of Georgia. The parent can come to the hearing and be a part of it, but they are not considered a party. So those are a few. Okay. There's a lot of changes, and the code really is giving judges a lot more discretion in coming up with favorable resolutions, but those are just a few that I highlighted on.
Thank you. Listening to Catherine Bortz with Bortz Law, LLC. And so we talked to Randy and Robert. Do you have to have an R to work at that firm, whatever? I'm rich. I could. sorry. I'm easily diverted. Yeah, higher. Nice. Sorry, Robert. Yeah. All right. So, but no, seriously. So we were the reason I referenced them because we were talking about that. What's criteria and some points you look for in terms of family divorce issues, whatever, right? So in terms of juveniles or parents looking to hire an attorney for their child, what were some key indicators or what would you recommend?
I would definitely want to recommend parents that find an attorney for their child who has experience in the juvenile court. I would say really ideally 8 to 10 years, someone who understands that the rules are different. The playbook is different. The attitude, the perspective, so many parts are different. And you want an attorney who understands that.
Right.
And in addition, you want an attorney that that you can talk to. I mean, I jokingly say this, but parents, you know, a lot of the parents are really losing their mind. And what I am trying to help them is to show them that, look, this is just a speed bump in life. And so they want an attorney that they feel comfortable talking to and that their child feels comfortable talking to and that they have a very clear line of communication and that they can talk to that attorney when they need to. And so those would be some key factors that I would say.
So you've had a lot of attorneys on, obviously on the show during the year, but I don't know if there's, that seems not really a niche, but it is definitely a specific, you know, part of the legal industry or field or profession is just dealing with, and that can be life-changing. There's some the ripple effect of that.
Absolutely.
If it's not dealt with right, as that child progresses through life, they could end up, you know, places they you know, that you could have prevented them from going. And then the amongst their other siblings,
absolutely,
right? The impact of their siblings and that just, I mean, the.
I wonder that I know that a lot of these parents probably had no idea, and I'll tell you because
it kind of hits them blindsided, right?
Yeah, because my first child was wonderfully perfect, and I thought, well, I can have a lot of these.
Right.
My second child, Jacob, love you, boy.
He came along, and I
went crazy. Just, I mean, I think I'm surprised I still have hair. Like,
sure,
he turned my whole world upside down, and you know, we're trying to still rein him in, you know, but just. I mean, I could just see that happening without even.
And every child is different, and they need, you know, what they need to get them on track may be different. You know, I have parents who say, I really want you to crack down, you know, on my child and, you know, scare them.
Yeah, scared straight type of
approach. You know,
my
response to that is simply going into the courtroom is scary.
Sure.
I mean, they have to go through security. They have to stand in front of a judge. They have to kind of wait around to be called into the courtroom. And, that experience, you know, can be eye-opening. Now it isn't, but that may not work for every child. There are children that doesn't phase them. So
that would be Jacob.
You know what? It's Randy. I'm glad we're on the show with Catherine because there is another side of juvenile court that Rob is really working hard to get more involved in, and he's done a lot of juvenile court work on the civil side. Not when the children get into trouble, but when the parents have issues. Juvenile court is a whole other world than superior court.
It's a very different beast. Yeah. It's very different.
I mean, what are some differences that come to mind? From a listener's perspective or someone that...
I mean, Catherine, you could probably tell me if you agree, but I feel like there's definitely a set of rules.
Right.
You know, we have the Civil Practice Act, but in juvenile court, the judge cares about one thing. How are we going to make these kids better?
Right.
What's in their best interest? What can we do? I don't care about the rules. Just tell me what we can do. We're going to bring in whoever we can to advocate for them. So.
And he's absolutely right. It's rehabilitation. That's actually in the code. It lays it right out, that rehabilitation, whereas in adult court, it's punishment is the goal. So
I don't know if this is a fair question, but how many times is the child really necessarily at fault, you know, kind of point fingers, but is it the environment? I mean, how much, you know, the family, I don't know how to really phrase the question. You know what I mean? Because there are just kids that are just, you know, troubled kids and have their own issues, but where's the boundaries of, like, does the court come in and say, okay, this is a bad environment for the kid's not necessarily at fault, right? Mm-hmm. In removing the kid from that environment or penalizing the parents or...
Yeah, generally what's going to happen is DFACS, the Department of Family and Child Services, is going to come in and
make that determination.
Make that determination, investigate, pull them out temporarily, put them with someone that can protect them for a while. Mm-hmm. You know, we've had horrible, horrific cases.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you talk about the worst divorces... they're nothing compared to the child cases that we've had.
Mm-hmm. DFACS, the Department of Family and Children Services, they are powerful. They don't wait for a judge. They can come in and say, this child is coming out of this household now. You know, act now,
no
ask
questions
later.
Asked.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And the judge, ask questions later, yeah.
And the judge is going to put their stamp on that for sure.
No, just piggybacking on that, I literally once had a DFACS person say to me, the Constitution does not apply to us.
Wow.
So,
you know, it's a balance because what's best for the kids.
Yep.
Should trump the law sometimes, and you know,
or at least temporarily get him out of that environment. Because I mean, how many times have we hesitated or blinked, and then a horrible situation?
Read about it every day, and of course, we see the people that come in and say, "I did nothing wrong. My kid fell down the stairs and has a black eye," and DFACS came and took my kid. My kid's going through trauma, living somewhere else for 3 days until they clear us. So. There are two sides to that story, but protect the kids first.
So, Catherine, let's sum up with the last question for you. Advice for the parents that I was kind of talking about earlier, whose child may be going through the juvenile court process.
Sure, and Rob kind of hit on this, or you both discussed this, as far as the rehabilitation and the goal of the juvenile court being looking out for the best interests of the children. So I always like to remind my parents that that is the goal. Mm-hmm. Take a deep breath. It's not punishment as in the adult court system, and that you can really focus on knowing that you're in a court that is looking out for the best interests of your child. So that really, and that's the cornerstone of the system. Mm-hmm. So I like to remind my parents of that. And then lastly, just encourage them to get involved, because when you go into a courtroom and you've got a whole family there supporting the child, the judges notice, the prosecutors notice, it certainly helps the outcome of the case. And so that would be my advice.
Oh, good. Thank you. Let's tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you. You've got a lot of social media.
Oh, sure. really, just you could check out my website, which is www.bortzlaw.com, or call me at 404-829-2776.
Great. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
We are close to the hour.
Yeah, we're almost out of time. I got a couple of thoughts, but open up to our guests as well if there's any.
I want a book. I want a copy of your book.
Okay.
Okay, nice.
I want a copy of your book.
It's done. It's a trade.
It's done. Yeah, it's a trade. Yeah. When I get a book, everybody gets a book. I'll be like Oprah. Everybody gets a book. Right now, I just have a pamphlet, whatever. Yeah. I had a couple of thoughts, and feel free to interject amongst yourself with the panel here as well. But for Terry, I don't know if we kind of touched on this, but obviously the emphasis was on personal issues of finance. Do you deal with any business?
No.
Okay.
No, I don't. I don't do any Chapter 11 or anything.
But you probably
like
refer folks to them.
Absolutely. Yeah. There are a lot of great attorneys in town here in North Georgia that do business. That's very. That's of being a specialty bankruptcy, commercial business bankruptcy is a subspecialty.
Yeah. Yep. Well, I always appreciate that the attorneys say, you know, it a lot of moving parts to what you do. So seek out a specialist seems to be kind of a theme with it, right?
Yep. Yes.
Yes or yes?
Yes.
Yeah. For Randy and Robert, I don't know if this is a fair question, but I was thinking of how to phrase this. Of the last, say, 10 clients or 100 clients, what are the top, you know, like the David Letterman, the top three reasons for divorce? I have one that's on the short list I think most people would think of.
Cheating.
That's an unfair question.
Okay, cheating?
Cheating's huge. Right. I think...
I'll tell you what. My thought is experience. The grass is greener on the other side. People, you know, to me, divorce is not about money. It's not about It's about how do I make myself happy? And I've tried dieting, I've tried therapy, I've tried maybe illegal drugs. What am I going to try next?
So it's his fault or her fault, yeah.
Yeah, I think people, you know, it's about will I be happier when it's all over? And like Rob said, cheating, you know, a lot of times it causes the divorce. A lot of times it's the linchpin that my marriage was bad, it was bad, it was bad, but I'm sticking with it because there's nothing else out there. Ah, there's something else out there.
Now it gives me a reason or excuse for the final straw. I was thinking money would be, I've always
money, financial trouble.
If you think about it, nobody's better off financially after a divorce. Nobody. Yeah. Even Tiger Woods' wife. She got, what, $500 million? Right. Well, before she got divorced, she had $1 billion, right?
So, that's a good point.
Nobody's better.
Yeah, and this, Terry, that's a pressure point in bankruptcy, too. Yeah, really same.
And I'd like to, go ahead. Oh, you look like you're getting ready.
No,
I'd like to wrap up the show, being that it's 9 o'clock.
You need a gavel. That's what we need is a gavel in here, right? Would that be cool?
But I would like to quickly plug the Atlanta Legal Experts, the new LinkedIn group that we have going on. We've got about 293 members today. And this is what the story is. But around this table, we have the family law, we have the bankruptcy, we have the juvenile court, the juvenile criminal law. And that's kind of, people have been passing cases back and forth around this table. We're taking that to the next level with networking events, and we're actually going to put you guys in front of other people that can send you money and send you cases.
And I heard you mention 3A sponsored it. They are wonderful people, and they are a wonderful group. And they, if you're a lawyer starting a practice or in the middle of a practice, they just do great things. They'll bounce ideas off you. So,
You can't get a better endorsement than that. Yeah,
I know. And he's been a great, great supporter of the show. So, and Peachtree Offices. That's where we'll be wrapping up our Atlanta Legal Experts radio show. Tune in next week.
Yep, from the beautiful Peachtree Offices studio. See you next week.